Good evening. This is the Voice of America in Washington. Welcome to another edition of Reporters Roundtable. I'm Douglas Simpuga. This evening, we'll talk about the militant group Boko Haram and its impact on West Africa. And with us tonight is my colleague, Bello Galandanchi of VOA's Hausa Service. Bello, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Douglas, for having me on the show.
You're welcome. We also have Dr. Andrews at Asamoah. Andrews is a senior researcher at the Institute for Security Studies. He joins us by phone from the South African capital, Pretoria. Good evening, Dr. Asamoah.
Good evening, and thanks for having me, Douglas.
You're welcome. Gentlemen, once again, welcome to the show. And as I said, our topic tonight is Boko Haram and the implications for the region, especially West African region. As I said, Boko Haram, that militant group, has killed thousands of people in northern Nigeria, where millions are displaced. Coalition troops from West Africa claim sweeping gains, recapturing some territory from the terrorists. And just last weekend, Boko Haram pledged allegiance to the militant group Islamic State. So let's start from there, Andrews. How significant is that pledge of allegiance to ISIS?
A number of ways. If you look at the trend of terror at the moment, it does appear Boko Haram is trying to use it in a number of ways. One, to position itself to buy into the publicity that surrounds ISIS. They're also trying to use that to make it easy to recruit, also make it easy to get some source of funding, but generally to try and tap into, you know, the morale boosting that comes with it. But that said, it's significant because of what ISIS particularly represents and what Boko Haram is trying to position itself to try to want to do in the sub-region. As to whether that will impact the way Boko Haram will do business on the ground, we are yet to see that. But that has a great deal of significance going forward.
So, in your opinion, who benefits from this relationship? Boko Haram gains or ISIS gains?
I think that ISIS gains a bit in the sense that now it means that the franchise they are trying to prop across the world is being bought by certain elements in Africa. So on that front, ISIS gains. Mm-hmm. But on the part of Boko Haram, they have some gains, but they will also be attracting, you know, all the enemies in quotes that are going after ISIS. Mm-hmm. Because as much as you try to buy into the publicity that ISIS, you know, and the brand that ISIS presents, we also need to understand that the form of terror that ISIS is now projecting is really something that the world is mobilizing against. So as much as Boko Haram tries to buy into that aspect, they will also be inviting a great deal of resistance from the international community.
I see. Bello, from your reporting, from what you hear from the region, how did the people get this news that now Boko Haram is pledging allegiance to the Islamic State?
Well, the people do not place a lot of significance to information coming out of Boko Haram. Mm-hmm. What they are really looking forward to see is all the territories held by Boko Haram have been recaptured. Mm-hmm. As of now, there's only two big towns. Actually, we don't have confirmed reports, but mm-hmm. There are reports that one of these two huge towns have been recaptured by the Nigerian military. So these towns are Goza and Bama. Bama mm-hmm. has been recovered, and now the only large town held by Boko Haram is Goza. So the question here is, why is Boko Haram pledging allegiance to ISIS mm-hmm. at this point? Mm-hmm. Very crucial point, elections are coming, and then you have all the coalition forces just teaming up against Boko Haram. Mm-hmm. Well, we could take a look at how they lost a lot of territories, mm. how most likely their finances might be cut short because now you have all these coalition troops surrounding Boko Haram in the northeast. So those are some elements that we really have to kind of understand at this point before we kind of see what Boko Haram's pledge to ISIS will mean to the war against terror in Nigeria.
I see. Andrews, those who say that maybe Boko Haram's declaration was a result of weakness, that they had, having had suffered some losses and lost some territory, they were getting weaker. Do you buy that argument?
Not fully, you know, because assessing the strength of groups like Boko Haram is not really so much about their strength on paper, but their relative strength in terms of the countries they are dealing with. And we see, we've seen Boko Haram has easily been able to take a lot of territories. They don't require too much to actually cause a lot of havoc because of the guerrilla tactics they are using. So if you look at it that way, even though some territories will be taken away from Boko Haram, we need to be very careful in terms of how we assess Boko Haram's strength, because we need to look at it in terms of what they are capable of doing and whether they have what it takes to do what they want to do. And I think that at the moment, Boko Haram does not need too much to cause a lot of havoc in Nigeria, even though they are also meeting stiff resistance. So from that perspective, I think it would be too early for us to conclude that they are getting weak and for us to celebrate. Even though they are losing ground, yes, that is significant. But in terms of the tactics they are using, the suicide bombing and all of that, I think they still have more than enough capacity to wreak havoc. And I think that is really where we need to place the emphasis.
Bill, at that point, because the people in the region, actually, where Boko Haram has been operating, they are still in a state of fear, because anytime they can attack, they are blowing up markets, they are blowing up transport hubs.
Well, at this point, we average about 1 to 2 suicide bombs per 24 hours. So that's the huge issue now, and these are the issues that we brought up to Nigerian intelligence officials and President Goodluck Jonathan. Their argument is, well, Boko Haram is about to get destroyed, so they are using everything they have at this point to strike fear in the Nigerians. So we see suicide bombings in mostly motor parks where there's a lot of people, just to kind of send a shockwave of fear to people. And well, I don't think it's okay to buy the argument that Boko Haram is getting destroyed, but there is something different going on with Boko Haram, covering it for years, just seeing at this time a very crucial moment to the Nigerian elections and security, and then you have all these coalition forces. We see reactions of Boko Haram in ways we've never seen before.
Do the people in those areas buy the government's argument that they are defeating Boko Haram? Because it's been years now and nothing has happened. Has the coming in of the coalition forces brought some confidence among the people who are living those areas?
I wouldn't say confidence, but at this point, what we get from people, they're starting to be optimistic that Boko Haram might be gone. But still, there's a lot of fear, because there were several towns that were captured by Boko Haram, recovered by Nigerian troops, recaptured by Boko Haram, and you get all that back and forth. What they're afraid of is what will happen. Even if these towns get recovered and they move back, is Boko Haram going to come back? Is Nigerian troops going to be able to protect them? Let's keep in mind, during the abduction of the Chibok girls, actually, military officials know about, you know, the whereabouts of Boko Haram heading towards Chibok, but nothing was done. This was reported by Amnesty International. So people are still skeptical as to whether to take and believe what the Nigerian government and politicians and security forces are telling them. Most likely it will take a little bit of time just to access if this progress that we're seeing is actually going to be sustainable.
Andrews, still on these coalition forces, these of Cameroon and other countries, neighboring countries that are taking the fight to Boko Haram, do you think they'll take the fight to Nigeria itself and flush out Boko Haram forever, or they are just doing this to prevent the group from spreading to their own countries?
I think in the long term, it will have to come to that if really they need to deal with Boko Haram sustainably. But I think that each member of the coalition is really interested in the kind of threat that Boko Haram presents to their territories. And so even though they may end up doing that, I think that in the interim, many of them will be much more preoccupied with the kind of threat that Boko Haram presents to them. If you look at fatality figures for Cameroon, for instance, as of last year, Cameroon also lost quite some, you know, significant people. More than 1,000 people were reported dead in various issues surrounding Boko Haram in Cameroon. So many of these countries will prop up their actions, particularly to try and provide security for themselves. But in a more sustainable way to deal with Boko Haram, you will then have to act in Nigeria, because that is really where they are based. And the ease with which they cross the border is a factor, but dealing with them sustainably has to be in Nigeria. But that would then bring in a great deal of geopolitical issues, because as to whether Nigeria will be very comfortable with some of its neighbors acting on its territory and all that, is something that we are yet to see. But I think that going forward, that is really necessary.
Yeah, and again, elections are due just in less than two.
March 28th, yes.
Correct. Will those people in those areas be able to vote? How is the situation now from what you're reporting?
Well, INEC officials, that's the Independent National Electoral Commission, officials of Nigeria have reiterated that all the people are going to be able to vote, and they've been giving them the permanent voter card even when their territories were not recovered. Interesting, us as reporters, we want to watch out and see what actually happens. Yes, we have some reports of people from Northeast getting their PVCs, even selling them. But are there polling centers in those towns that were recovered? These are questions we still have for INEC, and we're waiting for them to answer.
Well, because there is one of the reasons for postponing the election was because they couldn't guarantee security in those areas. Is now the Nigerian military sure that they can protect people at the polling stations as they go to vote or something?
You know, this is a very interesting point you brought up, because yesterday, top Nigerian intelligence officials, they blamed INEC for postponing the election. They said, you know what, it's not the military that is not ready, actually. INEC wasn't ready, and they put the blame on the military.
Yeah.
And then we just have to take the blame, because what they say was right. We cannot provide security. People have been killed and blown up every day. So it's really interesting who is ready and who is not. But what really is the cause for postponing the election? That still is a big question.
That's indeed a big question, because there are rumors and whispers even then, when the election was postponed, that maybe the reason was not what the government said it was. Well, let's take a short break. We'll be back in a moment to continue discussion of the militant group Boko Haram and its regional implications. Well, let's continue. Let's do away with the break. Andrews, there are those who believe that the Nigerian government bears some blame on letting this militant group fester. But now we're getting news, some reports that now the government may have opted to hire mercenaries, including some from South Africa. Have you heard about that?
Yes, it's been an ongoing issue that we are following on our end.
And go ahead.
No, I think the interesting thing first is the fact that it signifies some renewed commitment on the part of the government to do something about the Boko Haram threat. Even though on the other side, it also then means that, you know, the government admits the lack of capacity at certain levels, and hence the involvement of, you know, foreign elements in certain aspects of the operations on the ground. But as to whether for all these years this could have been done is a big question, because this then ties into the whole politics and the postponement of the election and suspicions of wanting to buy time to try and make impressions. That also has implications on where the many people are going to cast their ballots around the question of security. So it's interesting, but in South Africa, it's also raising questions as to whether South Africa has been able to deal with, you know, the likes of executive outcomes and the involvement of ex South African soldiers in kind of warfare outside South African territory. Even though at the moment we are not sure yet what exactly the roles of these so-called mercenaries are, whether they are just providing capacity building support, airlift support, or whether they are doing real combat. I think we are still following it, and we'll be able to have solid information on these as the days go by.
Mr. Andrews, actually, yesterday VOA had an interview with President Goodluck Jonathan, and he was asked the same question. are there mercenaries in Nigeria? And he said they are
technicians.
They are technicians. Well, but the intelligence officials, they said, no, there is nothing like that, which is contradictory with what the president said. But it's really interesting. What is grabbing attention at this point is who takes credit for all these victories and all these successes. We can clearly say that we haven't seen Boko Haram being destroyed or stopped until that these coalition forces are part of the fight against Boko Haram. And but Nigerian military officials already are taking the credit from, you know, their releases and presses and interviews that we've been having with them. So when Boko Haram gets destroyed, if it will get destroyed, who will take credit for it? Who is responsible for it? I believe that's a big question that will have a lot of people wanted to chime in on.
But Bello, the trouble, you want to jump in, Andrews? You can go ahead.
Yes, I think we should prepare for a long war with Boko Haram. I mean, I think it's very early for us to talk about, you know, destroying Boko Haram. Groups like Boko Haram, they become much more deadly when they are actually on the losing side, because that is when they lay down the options of, you know, of survival mode, and they may actually cause more havoc when they are on the back foot. So I think that we should prepare to be in a long war, because it's not going to be easy to completely obliterate groups like Boko Haram.
Mr. Andrews,
even though yes.
Can I cut you? How can Boko Haram fight if its sources of funding, which is basically capturing territories, stealing money from the banks, taking money from people, and anything they could grab onto there, if all those are being almost destroyed by or curtailed, how can Boko Haram continue this fight when you know, a lot of the people that they usually force to be their foot soldiers are now going back to their towns, or the towns where they usually go to attack all these people are now protected by the Nigerian military? These are questions that we are actually asking, and it's really looking... Yeah, go ahead.
But you know, as I said, groups like Boko Haram, you need to assess them in terms of their capacity on paper, yes, but also their relative strength in relation to the country.
When you say their
Nigeria,
capacity on paper,
whether they have the capacity to act based on few resources, because they do not need too much to be able to create the kind of havoc that they thrive on.
That's true.
They do not need more than a grenade to cause havoc in cities and towns. And I think that is really where the real threat is.
I see.
And so we will be able to curtail the source of funding. We'll be able to stop them from recruiting massively. But the kind of capacity they have now, it will take some time before they are completely exhausted. And I think that is really where the threat is. And as I indicated, once they kick into survival mode, they will go all out. So you can actually then see the violence going up or getting worse before it gets better. And so that is not to say that all the initiatives that are being rolled out will not function in the long term. But what I'm saying is that we will need to be realistic about our expectations, because we will then need to engage more and more before we see an overall impact going forward. And that will really take time.
I see. Well, you are listening to Reporters Roundtable, and we're coming to you live from the Voice of America studios here in Washington. Our topic tonight is the militant group Boko Haram, regional implications. And our panelists are Bello Galandachi of VOA's House of Service and Dr. Andrews Atta-Asamoah, a senior researcher at the Institute for Security Studies. Bello, following up on the point of Andrews there, you see, if they turn into insurgency mode, they don't need to have whole territory or to have a standing army to cause havoc. And that's why you need the people themselves. And it gets complicated if you have maybe mercenaries, maybe troops from other countries trying to flush out people who are within the community. Is that a problem?
Certainly, it is a problem. Usually that's when you get casualties of civilians, people who really don't have anything to do with it. But we as reporters, we always know that the permanent way to solve conflicts or to solve misunderstandings is dialogue. We know that armed fights really do not bring ends to these kinds of problems. But what is really interesting here is we don't see any effort made for dialogue at this point. There were previous efforts that failed, but now we don't see any effort for dialogue. Mm-hmm. What does this mean to the fight on Boko Haram? I believe Dr. Andrews might have something to say on this.
Yeah, Andrews, because you see, there must have been underlying issues that allowed Boko Haram to thrive and expand in that region. Those issues are not being addressed at all.
Touching on the issue of dialogue, I think that dialogue is very important, as he indicated. But I think we should open that as another approach whilst also pursuing the military option. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying that purely on the basis that, you know, violence is a language, the kind that Boko Haram is using. It's a language. And so to be able to really deal with the issue, first we need to try and understand what they are trying to say through that language of violence they are speaking. And if you get into that, you then realize the issues of marginalization and all those issues that underlie the kind of threats that we are seeing from Boko Haram. Now, what it also then means is that because it's a language, violence is a language, once they speak it, sometimes they do also understand it. And so those who will keep on engaging in violence and may not opt for dialogue, those can actually be dealt with in the military way. But we will need to keep an open channel of dialogue and amnesty for those who are willing to defect to the government side, so that we don't treat the whole Boko Haram as if it's a homogeneous group that is not interested in talking, and also shut the doors to those who want to defect to the government side. And I think that will really help. The over-militarization at the moment doesn't really help the matters much, because it's actually boot for boot, and that is really not going to help. Because for groups like Boko Haram who are selling the whole message of martyrdom, the more you kill, the more you create room for more recruitment. And so over-militarization doesn't help in the long run. So I do agree that dialogue is important. But as to whether the Boko Haram is ready to talk now is another question. Amnesty then will be an important option, mm-hmm. open for all those who are ready to defect to government, such that at any point that they feel they've been pushed enough and want to defect to government, then that is an open channel. The government can then engage them. But those who want to keep communicating through the barrel of the gun, I think that it's important that the structures of the state engage them, if that's the language they understand.
Because you see, some of these foot soldiers of Boko Haram are actually conscripted. So they don't join out of their own free will.
No, they were forced after their towns are captured. Yes.
So that makes it. As he says, if you leave some escape route for these ones, if they had the chance, maybe they would surrender.
Absolutely. But now the one actually domestic problem that is brewing is mistrust among communities. When people go back to their towns, they don't trust each other. A lot of times there is blame. Oh, you are the person who showed my house to Boko Haram, or you are the person. So that's the problem that is brewing at this point. I don't know if Dr. Andrews has an idea of usually how us journalists can tackle problems like this.
Yeah, and Father Andrews, then in that case, how do you respond to the increased the track taken by the international community? France, we just learned, will be increasing its West African force battling this group people. As we know, Cameroon, Chad, Niger, and Benin raising forces. So, all-out war alone may not solve the problem.
Yes, I agree. But for the international community and Western powers, we do know that there's their policy on not speaking to terrorists. It's quite open. It's quite out there. We all know. So for them, it will be contradictory for them to tell Nigeria to engage. I think it is up to Nigeria, knowing the nature of the threat, to find ways of dealing with it in a way that fits the situation. And that is where Nigeria will then have to adopt means beyond just military engagement. Because there's a role for military engagement, but certainly there's also a much more prominent role at the moment required for non-military options. But touching on the issue of the suspicions, I think it's coming from the fact that, one, we are not appreciating the suspicions that exist in those communities. First, at the level of the fact that not everyone supports Boko Haram, but also the kind of suspicions that surround those who are coming, because we do not prepare the community to receive such people. Neither do we spend time actually also working on defectors before we integrate them. And so if the person who showed your house to Boko Haram yesterday comes back and claims he defected, mm-hmm. I mean, what are the chances that they are going to believe that it's real defection and not just an implant? So I think that at that level, education is important, and that is one role that the government will have to play. But again, government can partner with civil society organizations that are involved in reintegration processes, and also the media in terms of, you know, pushing out the right message before these people can go back and settle into the community. Because once a civilian takes a gun and fights, you know, the mindset and a lot of other things change. And so pushing that individual back to society as if nothing happened is actually very unfair, because for both the victims of what he might have done, but also the person's unreadiness to readjust into society. So a lot of things need to be done. But at the moment, we seem to be concentrating only on dealing with Boko Haram and stopping them. Mm-hmm. Not really some of these consequences that follow.
And Bello, there is even mistrust among the leaders in that region and versus those in Abuja.
Yes, there is mistrust between leaders, federal government, and some of the state governors. Mm. We've had a state governor, one of the states that had a state of emergency, Adamawa State. His name is Murtala Inyako, who accused President Jonathan of perpetrating a lot of the Boko Haram attacks, and now he was impeached recently, and now you have a Borno state governor too, sometimes on the fire. Sometimes being accused. The most important, Chibok girls. That's one subject that is really huge on the Boko Haram agenda. President Goodluck Jonathan's wife actually accused Borno State Governor of not protecting the girls, so he should go and find them. So this tells you the disunity or disjointment between you know, some of the state governors and local leaders, and then you had the federal government of Nigeria.
And lastly, and very briefly, will the outcome of the election change anything on the ground, you think, or it doesn't matter whoever wins, the situation remains the same?
Well, at this point, with the military campaign going on, all options are open.
I see. Yes. We're out of time. In 10 seconds, Dr. Andrews, do you think the election may have an impact on the situation?
No, I think Boko Haram is a force we need to contend with. Whoever comes to power or whoever stays will have to grapple with the Boko Haram crisis, because it's come to really change the trajectory of the country's development, and it will have to be contained as such.
I see. Well, that wraps up this edition of Reporters Roundtable. I'd like to thank our panel, my colleague Bello Galandachi of Yours Hausa Service. Bello, thanks so much for being the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
And many thanks to Dr. Andrews at Asamoah, a senior researcher at the Institute for Student Studies in South Africa. Andrews, thanks a lot for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Our producer was Jackson Mvunganyi, and our engineer tonight was Mama Zahari Abzaidi. I will be back again next week with another edition of Reporters Roundtable. A reminder that in case you missed any part of this program, you can still access it by going to our main website at www.voanews.com. Just click on Programs and scroll down through Reporters Roundtable. You can also drop us a line. Our email is reporters@voanews.com. Thanks very much for tuning in tonight, and until next week, I'm your host Douglas Simfoga in Washington, wishing you all the best.